Okay, this is the Sunday, October 29th review session. Right? Okay, you all got your clocks. How many of you showed up an hour ago? Guy on the point this morning was very confused about the time, the DJ, and he announced it wrong twice over a 10-minute period. And then he finally got the time right because he synchronized his watch with the clock on the wall and proceeded to tell us for the next 20 or 30 minutes that it was whatever the correct time was, but he said Eastern Daylight Time. He'd sort of missed the point of the change, which was to get us out of daylight time to standard time. But at 8 o'clock, he got it right. He said, okay, I have to apologize. We're on Eastern Standard Time. And then he very cleverly said, but I've been running on Eastern Clueless Time. That was my laugh for the day. You can give me another one if you'd like, but that was the good one. Okay. We have an exam tomorrow, right? Yeah. Class time. On cognitive development? All right. Just checking. Okay, I don't want to be on Eastern Clueless Time. All right. What do you want to know?
Are there sex differences in intelligence? And I know it mentioned something, but it kind of said there wasn't. It kind of said there wasn't.
The question is, are there sex differences in intelligence? And the text sort of says a little bit, but not very much, and they're not important. And yes, there are. And the most important thing about the sex differences literature is that you have to look at when the measure is taken and what tests are used. There are not differences in IQ scores anytime. There are differences in verbal fluency that are relatively consistent from about, well, before you can actually measure them, because girls are earlier and more fluent. Their vocabularies are bigger during preschool years, and they learn language more quickly. There used to be differences in math, but those have disappeared, typically. And there are clear and persistent differences after puberty on spatial relations tests, particularly manipulation of spatial images, use of three-dimensional space for rotation and things of that sort. That's the persistent one, that the spatial relations ability, which underlies some kinds of math and some kinds of physics, show group average differences. And it's very, 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 very important in looking at all of the sex differences based on tests . The comparison they're making is between the boys and the girls on average score, and most of the, I've even exaggerated this one, so you're looking at distributions which typically overlap completely, so that the lowest functioning boys are equal to the lowest functioning girls, the highest functioning girls are equal to the highest functioning boys. And the differences are usually so small that you can't describe the functional difference between two people who have those average scores, those two different scores. But if you have enough subjects, statistics will let you say that there is a real difference. So it's very important whenever somebody says there are differences between any group to remember that there's an IQ difference between people west of the Mississippi and east of the Mississippi. There's an IQ difference between people in Illinois and Indiana that's statistically significant. And there are differences between males and females, but not an IQ score. On the other hand, if you look at performances on several tasks, there are differences not in intelligence, but in the way people think and their performance on particular kinds of tasks. And one that's related to the verbal fluency is, it's a neat test. I just ask you, I'll give you a list of words and ask you to come up with as many synonyms for each of them as you can in 10 minutes. And what will happen is that about 80% of you, well, there'll be a difference, let's put it this way. And the difference will be fairly large. And there'll be a range of scores, and the difference between the males and the females will actually be fairly large. But the really neat thing is that about 80% of the women will do really well on that test, and about 20% of them will be significantly lower. And if you look at the men, about 80% of them will do not very well on that test compared to the women, but about 20% of the men will be up there with the women. And it turns out that the best research we have suggests that there are two different kinds of brains and they operate differently. And one kind of brain tends to separate verbal and emotional functions and compartmentalize itself so that the left and right hemispheres are working independently. And that kind of brain does really well on spatial relations. You see the same thing there, except the percentages will be reversed. But if you have the brain that separates the two halves, the two hemispheres, you're likely to do poorly on the verbal fluency and really well on the spatial relations. The other kind of brain tries to integrate the two halves. And people who have that kind of brain, who tend to be female, the 80% of females have that kind of brain, but 20% of guys have. Those are very, very rough estimates of the percentages. Those do badly on spatial relations and really well on verbal fluency. But it's not a sex, it's not gender, it's not whether you're male or female, it's whether your brain is lateralized for those functions. If it is, it'll do better on the spatial relations, poorly on the math. If it's not lateralized as much, it'll be the other way. So what that suggests is that we're beginning to get a handle on where the sexes might differ and understanding that it has something to do with the way our brains develop. And the spatial relations difference, the women who have very good spatial relations ability tended to have high prenatal androgen levels. It was before they were born, they were exposed to androgens, and that's highly correlated. None of that will be on the exam, but I couldn't resist the opportunity to put that in. Okay, just I needed you to hear that because we didn't talk about it. But it won't be on the exam because we haven't talked about it. But whenever somebody raises the question of sex differences, I go off on a what is, for me, real fun. And just to add to that, we have no idea when that lateralization happens for spatial relations and emotional stuff and verbal. What those studies reflect is college students and up, but we have no idea what children are doing or how our brains compartmentalize the different functions. Nobel Prize time in physiology. We can figure out how the brain works developmentally, how it changes. So, okay. You got another one? You're afraid to now. Ask another question.
Not really.
You're not afraid? I knew that. You would never be afraid. Okay. I promise to behave from now on. What is a constructivist view of intellectual development? What is a constructivist view of anything? Okay. And it has several components. Several features. Constructivism as a philosophy or as a viewpoint has several features. You remember what they are? Experiences, and in this case, intellectual development. We build our knowledge, we construct our knowledge, we create it from our experiences, which leads you to the underlying premise, which is that it's an active process engaged in by each of us individually. And it's our action in the world that creates that experience that we make sense out of. And as we continue to apply the knowledge that we're constructing, we expand it. Through differentiation and integration to make it more complex and more useful. But we're building it on the basis of our own experience, so it's dependent on the experience we're having, and it will reflect that experience. Our knowledge will reflect our individual experience. And it will be useful in situations that are not too different from the kind of experience that we've had. What did I leave out about constructivism? How does it differ from other views? What are the other views? Nativism, which says that what you learn is already built in, what you know is built in, and it just has to unfold. It's just there, and it unfolds in a timely pattern that is similar for all of us. And I try to say that without sounding too sarcastic. I don't believe it, but there it is. Yeah. That's enough. I said I would try to behave. Nativism is a contrary view. The contrary view to constructivism. The nativists don't talk to the constructivists. They speak different languages. The constructivists say you're not going to know anything that you haven't created from your experience, and you will understand whatever you learn from the perspective of the experience that you've had. You've developed those schemas. They will be what you base your understanding of any new concept on. And the nativists reject that point of view.
So the Piaget level work with constructivists?
He is one of our premier constructivists, and what he added in his stage theory was a way of describing the kinds of understanding that people can construct, and tried to explain the limits or why kids don't do calculus, or why kids don't do proverbs or analogies, why they can't do the kind of problems that we demonstrated in class when they're 5 or 6 or 8. And his argument was that they are limited by the maturation of the brain and the limits of the experience they've had so far. They're limited in the ways they can process information, and therefore what they can understand and how they can represent that understanding. So he says we start off with one set of skills based on our reflexes, and we engage in activity that leads us to sensory motor understanding. And we continue doing that the rest of our lives, but we add to it the ability to represent our experience linguistically, which is the second stage. And then as we develop more complex schemas, we develop logic that we can apply to those things that we can concretely experience. And then as we go through adolescence, we develop the ability to be logical about much more complex and abstract relationships. So we're adding those new skills as we mature, and then we get to be grown-ups and we've got it all integrated into a fairly complex system of understanding and changing our understanding and creating new understanding.
Can you explain naturalistic or ecological intelligence? You went over the topic briefly.
Yeah. Put it in everybody know the context? Naturalistic, the naturalist or ecological, which is my term, intelligence is one of the 8 that Gardner describes. Howard Gardner's notion of multiple intelligences, so we have several different kinds of intelligence that we use. And Gardner says that one of those that he calls a naturalist is the ability to understand the relationships among, he focused on the kind of intelligence that Darwin applied to understanding the ecosystem, and argues that it's understanding the flora and fauna and their relationships to each other in the natural world. I think listening to Gardner talk about that one, I think he's envious of people who can identify birds and plants, because I have the feeling he doesn't have a clue about them. That's not his big intelligence. But what he's describing is the kind of awareness that people develop, for example, that you can identify species of birds in several ways, and as you become familiar with them, you can identify them by their call, by the habitat they're in, by their behavior, by some combination of all of those. And if you, how many of you know what distinguishes a nuthatch? How many of you can identify a nuthatch? Okay. Nuthatches are one of the very few birds that can walk down a tree trunk head first. So if you see a bird walking down a tree trunk head first, and it's about that big, in New England, it's going to be a nuthatch. It's the only thing you'll see doing that. Why can it do that? Because instead of having three toes in one direction and one in the other, it has two toes in each direction, forward and back. Yeah. Minor thing. But what Gardner was describing in that intelligence is the ability to take that kind of information and put it together. And then, you know, evolutionarily, it would be useful because where there are nuthatches, there are particular kinds of trees. And where there are particular kinds of trees, strangely enough, it's called a nuthatch for a particular reason. It opens nuts. And if you're hungry, you follow the nuthatch and you'll find the nuts. You can open them yourself. The nuthatch won't do it for you. Yeah. So what Gardner is describing is the ability to put together the kind of information you get about an organism, about its ecosystem, its behavior, and to make sense out of those complex systems that we call ecosystems. My guess, and it carries no weight whatsoever, but the reason I use the ecological to label that is that I think it also applies to other kinds of ecosystems. I think that some of us develop or have the ability to develop an understanding of how lots of things fit together and to conceptualize, not just in the natural world, but in economics, for example. You think about how complex economics is, with people buying and selling and owning and not owning and labor, and put all of those things together, they create a very complex system. And I think the person who has that kind of intelligence to understand the natural world could also apply that to something like economics. Maybe. I think that's, as he describes it, that's what I'm hearing him say. Okay, and are you clear about Gardner's notion that there are multiple intelligences, each is based on an evolved part of the brain that was evolved to process particular kinds of information from a particular sense, and to process that information in particular ways and connect it to other kinds of information? And Gardner is arguing that all of us have all of those intelligences because they're a product of human evolution. But they lead us to different kinds of performances or accomplishments. And his argument also is that they vary genetically, that some people have a lot of verbal intelligent linguistic intelligence, other people have a lot of kinesthetic intelligence, others have a lot of interpersonal, and he argues that we each have a profile of potential, and then we develop one or more of those through our experience. He's also a constructivist. And we develop those that are useful in our environment. In our experience. On top of that, he says, our typical IQ test and our particular educational system favors mathematical, analytic, and linguistic, and doesn't pay much attention to the other kinds of intelligence. And he argues that we probably should be paying more attention to those others, because we have some people who are really frustrated in school. And maybe if we thought differently about what we're trying to teach and how we try to teach it, they would be able to be more successful in school. But it would require that we broaden our conception of what we're trying to get across and what kinds of skills we're trying to develop in kids. What else is scary or confusing?
I have sensory pattern and action pattern in my notes, and I couldn't find a definition for it in the
book. Sensory pattern and action pattern. Probably from an overhead and some stuff that's on the website. When I was talking about the beginning of intellectual development, I think, trying to get across the point that when you're taking in through your senses, you're taking in experience, you're creating sensory patterns or schemas. You're recording those or schemes. You're remembering them. That's what the human brain does. The things that are repeated create sensory patterns. So a sensory pattern or scheme might be somebody's face that you've seen over and over again. And the ability to recognize that face as one that you've seen before that's familiar is a sensory scheme. It's a perceptual scheme, visual. There are also action patterns. Or schemes, and they would include things that we do over and over again. So I have a complex action scheme of tying my shoes. And the point was that those are the schemes that we develop into our knowledge. And that many of what we know are much of what we know is sensory or action, sensory and motor. The action is motor. So there's sensory schemes and there are motor schemes, and they're the combination of those. So I can tie my shoes in the dark. I don't have to have the visual sensation of that, but I do have to have the kinesthetic or the afferent feedback in my hands to do that. On the other hand, I can't do it upside down. Probably a better example for me is trying to tie my tie when I can't look in the mirror. I remember one incredible evening when I had taken off my tie and I was impressing my mother-in-law. That wasn't my point, but I happened to be in a room with my mother-in-law and I was trying to put my tie. I could not tie it. I could not tie it without looking in a mirror. I had to go find a mirror so I could tie my tie. Those schemes then get represented by language later. I don't represent, but I can, the process of tying my shoe. I can tell you how to do it, but it's better if I show it to you. Do it this way. Telling you to take the left lace and put it under the right lace and then do that again so you create and then draw it tight and then make a loop with your... See, we know a lot of things that we can't really represent in words very well. I'm struggling. But it's useful sensory motor knowledge. On the other hand, if you see a knot and it looks like your shoelace, you can probably figure out how to untie it instantly because it triggers a sensory pattern, a sensory scheme for you that's very, very familiar, assuming you can tie your shoes. So you can untie that very quickly when you see it. You can look at a six-year-old's shoes and know whether he tied them properly or she tied them properly. Okay. So you can apply that scheme to new situations. You can tell whether it matches. And when I talk to you about tying your shoes, you have a sense, you have some understanding of that. Some of you probably had difficulty doing it. Some of you still may have difficulty doing it. I grew up before Velcro was invented. Some of you probably never had to learn to tie your shoes, right? You just use Velcro. Wonderful invention. And then in a constructivist view, what you're doing with those schemes is representing them and then combining them. So if you're on a boat, for example, you may know three variations of the bow that you would use. I've forgotten what it's called in nautical terms. Anybody remember? The knot that you tie in your shoe it has a real name. It has a name that is independent of the shoes. But you also have other versions of it that differ in specific ways. You can make a right-handed or left-handed single loop bow. Your shoelace you tie in a double loop bow, but there are left-handed and right-handed single loop bows which are made similarly but with a different, so you can put those into a bigger scheme of different kinds of bows. And I also know that, you know, when you get really good at knots, that there are things for which you should not use that bow. It's not going to work right. It's not going to do what you want it to do. So you put your bow into a bigger set of concepts of knots. Knots for different purposes. Knots that have freestanding bites. The bite is the loose end. Knots that you can undo by pushing on the loose end is very important in sailing. To be able to push the end of a rope back through its knot and loosen it. Because sometimes you only have one hand because you're hanging on for dear life with the other. And the idea in nautical knots is that most of them you want to be able to untie with one hand. So you have a whole set of knots that you can do that with. And you create knots or you learn knots so that many of them can be undone by pushing the free end back through the loop that's holding it. And then there are times when you don't want that to happen. So you have another set of... See, that's just simply saying there's a huge potential body of knowledge about knots. And what you're doing as you're developing knowledge, if you're experiencing that, if you're a sailor, you learn those. And you learn when to use them. But if you're not a sailor, or don't have other uses for knots, if you don't do macrame, you don't need them. So you don't learn them. Isn't it neat that there's all that knowledge out there that you don't have? I don't have. But mine is unique, yours is unique, and that's the constructivist assumption, that each of us has the experience that we've had, and we've based our knowledge, we've constructed our knowledge out of that. We've constructed the things that we need. Get a good night's sleep. Pardon? Is what? Elaborate.
One of your questions is, can you make a person smarter than her genetic potential would allow?
Uh-huh.
So that potential that everybody has, you don't know what the potential is. How do you know what a
Trick question. That one is a trick question. If you can do it, it's within your potential. Anything you can do is within your genetic potential. The big question and the IQ tester's question is, what is your potential? But in fact, there are very few ways to measure potential. On the other hand, when you're looking at genetic potential, for particular kinds of intellectual skills or performances, you just look at the genetic pool. Any kid that Mozart's parents had would probably be fairly high in potential for musical ability. Because both of his parents came from musical families, so you got this reasonably good ear all the way up. I have no idea whether Einstein's son was... He didn't have a son, he had a daughter. Son. I've forgotten. Anyway, Einstein's offspring. May or may not have been a good physicist or mathematician, a theoretical physicist. I don't know. But the potential for abstract visual spatial relations skill was probably fairly high because that's what he had. One of the things he had. It's a trick question, and there's another one. In the next unit, can you make a person more sociable than her genetic potential would allow? And you can't. If she can get there, that's within her potential. What is the relationship between language and thought? You know what? I'm not even going to tackle that one. Yes, I am. Okay. But I'm not going to ask you on the exam. Okay. What? Yeah. It's a very interesting question, and it exercises psychologists of all stripes. You know, what is the relationship? And Piaget's answer to that and others is that thinking comes in many forms and is not necessarily linguistic. And Gardner's notion of multiple intelligences accepts that. It's compatible with that. Some of us think musically, some of us think spatially, some of us think interpersonally or intrapersonally and not necessarily linguistically. And language, as I said when we talked about what language is, it's a way of representing schemas and their relationships to each other. But it is only one way to represent. The language is one form of representation. But language is not the thought itself. But if you want to have a good debate with psychologists and linguists, ask them to discuss that. You know, what is the nature of language and what is its relationship to thinking? And I'll just tell you a little anecdote. My first wife and I had an ongoing discussion. We will not call it an argument. For about 25 years, starting before we were married, because in her view, all thinking was verbal. It was all linguistic. And I've never accepted that notion. But she was an incredibly linguistic, verbal person. And I suspect in many ways her thinking was largely verbal. It was largely represented by language, and she did think linguistically. but I don't. So, yes. I'm sorry. How many ways, can biological and cognitive changes relate to each other? So, if you're looking at biological development and tackling a question about cognitive development, how are they related? That's not live. It's not somebody in the rehearsal space. Is it? Is it? Too many tracks. Okay. I was just wondering if I have something up here I can turn the volume down. I know. So, what's the relationship between biology and cognition? Any relationship? Anybody?
You might learn as you grow. You might learn new things. So say you go through puberty, your body might look different, and people might treat you different because of the way you look. So you learn to act in your environment differently, so you change how you look.
Okay, so there may be different cognitive demands in the transactions you have with other people based on physical developments that you go through. When you develop, what's likely to be happening as you mature? When you're growing up as a child, biologically, what's happening? You're growing. Your brain is growing. So among the biological changes are changes in the brain. And the brain is what you think with. And the point of Piaget's stages, or one of the points of them, is that as you go through major changes, transitions in brain development, you add new skills. New ways of processing information. So each pair of stages is separated by major changes in the brain. And puberty is one of those. So that's one of the connections, that the brain is maturing, and as it does, you're going through cognitive changes as well. What about old age? What's happening to your, to you biologically? Remember that in the biology unit? Senescence, you're slowing down, you're getting less oxygen to your brain. Processing time is slowing down. Does that have any impact on your cognitive development? Some people are nodding their heads yes. Yeah. So the declines that happen in intellectual functioning in adulthood are connected to declines that are happening biologically. Not all of them, but many of them. Some of them are happening because you're not exercising the skills. So you're getting rusty. If you don't use something, you don't maintain it, whether it's muscle or bone or brains, vocabulary, math skills. If you use them every day, you keep them sharp. What other kinds of biological and cognitive connections can we make? Changes biological. What happens when you get sick? Ch- Should you take tomorrow's exam if you have 103 fever? Why not? A, you're contagious and we don't want you. B, you won't do well. C, you'll feel bad. And the combination of those, making yourself feel worse because you got out of bed, doing badly on the exam, and making the rest of us sick, it's a mess. Don't do it. So we don't take exams when we're sick because we know we don't do well on them. Should you eat a good lunch before the exam? Yeah, because we don't do well when we're hungry. Children don't learn when they are hungry. That's why we give them hot breakfasts and hot lunch at school if they're hungry, because you can't learn when you're focused on food and trying to figure out how to soften up your shoe so you can eat it. What about the other direction? Changes in your thinking affect your biological development? You can give yourself an ulcer from worrying too much. Actually, ulcers are... You can give yourself indigestion. What causes ulcers? Bacteria. Yeah. Particular kind. I'm going to block on the name. It's funny because we used to treat ulcers with... Only 90%. So the others are... Don't know. Okay. All kinds of things. You can give yourself a headache from thinking too much. Probably not. I doubt it. The text suggests, we were talking about it in the hall earlier, the text suggests that your IQ at age 11 is a moderate predictor of your longevity. Believe that? People who are smarter at 11, age 11, live longer than people who are less smart. I don't know what the difference is. I need to go look at that. I just noticed that in the text yesterday. I'm thinking, what? I had not heard that before, but the text reports it, and I need to go read the research. Is it because they're making better choices in adolescence? Don't know. Fascinating to chase that one down. What?
Sternberg?
I'm not going to ask anything about Sternberg. But essentially what he did was, he said there are different aspects of intelligence and people use them to different degrees. And if you're using one aspect, like I think he called it the componential, you tend to take things apart, break it down into its components. And it's actually an interesting kind of theory. Componential. Yeah. What he does is suggest three different kinds of ways of going about thinking. And each of them, people who use them, if they're using predominantly one or the other, they approach problems differently and they tend to do better at different kinds of work than other people. But I'm not going to ask you about it because we didn't talk about it. Anybody recognize that? Acquisitive? Shy? Shy. Yeah. S-C-H-A-I-E. Kay Warner Shy. Yeah, and he's described different things we use our intelligence for as we go through life. Acquiring new skills and then accomplishing things and so on.
Do we have to know about Perry?
Perry's useful, yeah. And particularly how people change across college. You know, how does your thinking change? You know, I went over it briefly in class. The text describes it. A boogie, huh? What?
Just Paul Baltes?
Baltes. Baltes. Yeah, generally the Seattle longitudinal study is important, and Baltes was one of the two major players in that. I'm not used to having a review session to music. I like it. Intellectual development and moral development. Yeah. The text talks about, describes Kohlberg's research in childhood and adolescence. Lawrence Kohlberg. And what Kohlberg did was study moral judgment. He would give kids and adolescents stories, particularly moral dilemmas, and ask them to make judgments about who was wrong, if anybody was wrong, what they did that was wrong, how they understood morality. He was trying to find out how we develop a sense of morality, and he was taking a cognitive approach to that. Probably the text doesn't say, I don't recall that it says, but anyway, Piaget had written a whole book on the moral judgment of the child, and Kohlberg was building on that. He was also disagreeing with some of the things that Piaget had said, but he was essentially doing the same thing and using many of the stories that the dilemmas that Piaget had used as he tried to understand and describe stages in morality. And much of the language that Kohlberg uses is based on Piaget. The question that the text addresses with Kohlberg's work is what is the relationship between the level of your thinking about anything and the kind of moral judgments that you make. And I think it's fair to say that the general conclusion that they give is that they're closely tied to each other, in the sense that you won't give a moral judgment that is more sophisticated than your thinking is generally. So your cognitive maturity underlies your moral judgment maturity. But it doesn't guarantee that you will make moral judgments that are as mature as your other cognitive skills. So it kind of sets the ceiling for them, but it doesn't guarantee that you'll be at that ceiling. In other words, you can be really bright and formal operational and still give moral judgments that are very immature. That you won't find. The question is, will you find somebody who has a very high level of morality or moral judgments that are very sophisticated? And Kohlberg has six stages that he describes, they're described in the text. you won't find somebody at the fifth or sixth stage who is not also formal operational. They don't do it. So you don't find sophisticated thinking about morality from people who are not cognitively mature. And the text also suggests that Kohlberg late in his life suggested a seventh stage, which is interesting in the way he described it, because it's really very close to what some people have called the post-formal stage, thinking beyond the logic that formal operations lets you do, going beyond Piaget into post-formal thinking. And if you go through that stage, then you might be more likely to think about moral issues in a more sophisticated way too. But Kohlberg died before he had a chance to elaborate on that. He drowned himself in the Charles in Cambridge. He had been doing research he'd actually been in several cultures, but he picked up a parasite in forgotten whether it was South America or Africa. Anyway, he picked up a parasite that is not, you can't get rid of it, and it causes joint pain, and he spent the last several years of his life suffering, and he apparently reached the point where he couldn't deal with it anymore. He was probably 65, maybe.
Should we know all the six stages?
No, you don't need to know all the six stages. Cross that one off quickly. But you should know generally what they're about and what he's describing when he's talking about moral judgment. And you should also be clear that there's a difference between moral judgment and moral behavior. You can reason very sophisticatedly about moral issues and still go out and do things that are terribly wrong. They're not very predictive. Your moral judgment is not predictive of your moral behavior. So those are two separate issues. He's really looking at intellectual performance of a sort, applied to moral issues. But it doesn't guarantee moral behavior. I'm sorry?
I was just talking
about. Ah, okay. Hungry? Tired? You're going to get a good night's sleep? I'm going to check on you. I don't want any of you up at 2 o'clock in the morning studying for this exam. You'll do better with a good night's sleep.